This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk about all things municipal. And we will talk about what was and what was not in it for Toronto in this week's provincial budget. And as you know, policies and bylaws are one thing, but they aren't much good without enforcement. And this week we learned that the dog and the dog owner implicated in that vicious attack on a 9-year-old boy were already in violation of the rules placed on them. The dog has a history of violence abetted by the owner, who is now out on bail and was previously found by a court to be an irresponsible dog owner. Now, counselors have told me that issues involving dogs are often the most heated and unresolvable. So I want to talk about that. And city staff is recommending that drinking should be allowed in parks everywhere after last summer's pilot project. I think that's a no-brainer. And the union and some councillors want to get rid of private sector garbage collection west of Yonge Street when that contract is up. And that is a brainless idea, in my opinion. What is your opinion? 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome Taylor Scollin, co-founder of The Peak, Councillor James Pasternak, Ward 6, York Centre, and Councillor Paula Fletcher, Ward 14, Toronto Danforth. Hi, everyone. Nice to talk to you.
Hi, Libby.
So here is my question, and here's what has me shaking my head. There are so many things in Toronto that are broken. There are so many things that could be improved. So why are we talking about garbage collection, which is not broken? Why are you guys talking about that, taking time? Councillor Fletcher.
Well, I don't think we were talking about that, but apparently one councillor is talking about that. So now we're all going to have to talk about that. The last time we talked about garbage was contracting out Area 4, and it was found that didn't make economic sense. Everything was working very well. So there's no report in front of us right now that I know about, Libby, so I guess that we'll be getting something that says, here's what it costs, here's what we think. And as councillors, we can always put something on the agenda. Whether it works or not, that's another matter.
Councillor Pasternak, I mean, to me, this is a waste of staff time, a waste of council time, and it turns out that the city doesn't even have land to park garbage trucks. So why is city council wasting time on this?
Well, it's a very, very good question. I mean, the bottom line is that it's very hard to flip back from outsource, insource, outsource, insource. There's so many things involved, including staffing, vehicles, infrastructure, maintenance, costs. So there was someone on council who wanted to debate it and wanted to get more details. So it's no harm in that. So we'll be taking a closer look on and see if we're on the right course.
Taylor, what's your view of this?
I defer to the councillors on this. You know, I've lived east of Yonge, I've lived west of Yonge. The garbage pickup has been fine in both locations. So, whatever makes most sense numbers-wise, I'm very comfortable with that.
Okay. I want to turn now to the issue of the violent dog and dogs off leash and all of that. I'm going to give the numbers out again because I'd like to hear from the audience on that. The numbers are 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And Paula, so we know that this dog was designated to be a violent dog. It was supposed to be muzzled outside of the owner's property. The owner has been deemed to be an irresponsible dog owner, and she's walking around. I mean, the dog is in custody now, but tell me about the whole issue of trying to deal with issues involving dogs and what your experience of that is.
So, Livy, I'm so glad you brought this up. But last summer, when one of my constituents in East York was badly mauled by a dog, I said, okay, how is the city handling dangerous dogs? Because it turned out this dog also had a dangerous dog order on it. And now it turns out that this terrible attack on this sweet young boy, that dog had a dangerous dog order. So how are we enforcing dangerous dog orders, and particularly with ones that have had severe bites, you know, may have had a nip or something, but these dogs have had a history of that. And I think there needs to be far more focus on these 540 dogs that currently have a dangerous dog order. And within those, who are the kind of top offenders? How do we make sure those owners are following the rules of having a dangerous dog order? The last council meeting, we did make a change where you used to be able to go to the hardware store and buy a beware of dog sign and post that. That meant nothing. There'll now be a city sign that says, there is a dog here under a dangerous dog order, which I think will ramp up the public's ability to complain when it's not being complied with. But it's a barn door closed, horses gone, Libby.
Well, exactly. And, you know, it's like everything else. If it's not enforced, and it certainly appears to not be enforced, and I guess, like, I don't know, bylaw officers, I see them out writing parking tickets, but isn't this more of a priority, Councillor Pasternak? Councillor Pasternak, are you there? James Pasternak?
Yes, no, this is a major issue. I've been bitten on my right arm by a German Shepherd, on my left arm by a Doberman. Even when we identify dangerous dogs, we can issue a muzzle order, but there's an appeal process. And many dog owners are successful when appealing it. So, I mean, people have to understand that they're opening themselves up to civil litigation if they have a dangerous dog that attacks someone and causes serious injuries. And I don't think they understand that. And maybe we should be having them carry more insurance so that people can more easily sue for restitution. But the bottom line is that the dog ownership has gone up exponentially since before the pandemic. And we have that. We have problems with safe dogs who go into schoolyards, who are always off leash. We're sitting on the laps of drivers when they're driving around the city, which is terribly dangerous. So we need a more rigorous protocol. We've adopted some new rules by council. We have to see how it goes, but I think we have to revisit this in about a year and see how it goes.
Well, a year and a lot of people can get hurt in a year. Now, I'm probably going to get a lot of flack for even saying this, but I thought that after really dangerous incidents, violent incidents, I thought those dogs are put down, Taylor.
Yeah, I was also under that impression. It seems like there's an issue with how this process is going through the appeals and the sorts of things that Councillor Pasternak mentioned. Also, there's clearly an enforcement problem here of some sort. I don't know if you saw this, but one of the people who lived in the apartment building with this dog complained to the police, and they said, well, there's nothing we can do about it, but we recommend you carry around a baseball bat. And I think that's got to be up there with leave your keys by the front door.
Exactly.
So
I was just going to say,
car thieves don't mug you, but it's absurd.
I mean, it's
good one.
It seems like at what point does a dangerous dog get put down, either of the counselors?
You know, it is, there's no requirement. First of all, their dogs can be apprehended. So in the case in East York, the owner agreed to have them put down, and she put them down because they'd had a dangerous dog order. That means they'd bitten somebody before, and she realized there's no way. I'm not sure in this latest case. I'm not sure what the situation is there with these dogs. They've been apprehended. So number one thing, if they've really mauled someone, they're apprehended. What exactly happens to them after that, I think, becomes a court issue. And there's a lot of provincial legislation here as well, Libby. It's not just city bylaw. City has a dangerous dog requirement. There's things you must do for that. If you're not doing them, bylaw enforcement can then take action against you. And I gather they'd take an action against her, but not severe action, if you know what I mean. Well, I'm very heartened by the police have jumped in a number of cases and laid actual charges, because the city can't lay those kinds of charges on an owner. There's no bad dogs. There's just really bad owners, Libby.
Well, I don't want to get into, I'm not qualified for that particular debate, but if the dogs can be taken, then why aren't they taken after they've really hurt somebody?
But they were taken. They were taken in this case. They were taken. Last year, they weren't. They agreed that she could take them herself. And I'm not sure that it's the city has to get an order to take the dogs. It's not, let me put it like this, it's not easy and straightforward, and it needs to be far more easy and straightforward. Once the police are involved, now it becomes easier. I know that much.
Well, I mean, it's like so many other things. It's not easy or straightforward. Before we get to the more global issue of reacting to the budget, since we have Taylor here, he's our designated younger person. So the province got slapped on the wrist for being way behind in building affordable housing. Mm. Yesterday, in a move that I thought was extremely performative, the Prime Minister talked about a renter's bill of rights. He doesn't have any jurisdiction there. And I mean, if there is so much more demand than supply, I don't know how knowing what the last rent was is going to help you.
Absolutely. I mean, I've rented my whole life, and there was nothing in that announcement that I felt would make my rent more affordable in any way. And it's as you say, how does knowing the price of the apartment 5 years ago help me negotiate now when there's a lineup out the door to rent every vacant apartment in the city? You know, I think this past week has kind of shown how all levels of government are deeply unserious about solving the housing affordability issue. And yesterday was no exception.
Paula Fletcher, is Toronto at risk? I mean, there have been jurisdictions that have been getting money from the province because the province says, hey, you guys are doing really well at building housing. And meantime, the province is getting this slap on the wrist. And the minister has said clearly that they might get less money than they were expecting. I would imagine that might trickle down.
Well, that might be a problem. I know that Toronto has no problem building housing. Just look at all the cranes. You can drive anywhere downtown without road closures for building. Unfortunately, they don't all have affordable housing in them. But we are coming along with that as well. So I think this must be other areas that aren't meeting the targets. And unfortunately, there's no way for the federal government to deliver dollars directly to a city that's performing or outperforming in the housing building industry, Libby.
Okay. I want to take a call before we get further into this conversation. We've got Sita in Mississauga. Hi, Sita.
Hi, Libby. Thank you so much. So charge anyone who don't have their dog on a leash, especially if they're in public and not in a dog park. Once a dog attacks someone, not only charge the owner, ban that person from owning another dog, also take that dog away. We go to the park a lot, and I can't believe people let their dog run up to people and saying to that person, oh, they're tame. And that person will turn around and pet that dog and saying, oh, you're so cute. But not all animals should be treated the same.
Oh, absolutely. But the problem is, who is going to enforce that? We don't have enforcement of the rules we have. Sita, thanks for your call. I mean, it sounds like perhaps the problem is not the rules, though it looks like, you know, bad actors get too many chances.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the councillors, I think, spoke to it already, how the process is too complicated to get these things resolved.
Okay, back to affordable housing. So, again, I mean, I live in Midtown Toronto, and it's almost impossible. And there are also projects that are stalled because they can't sell in high interest rates. And, I mean, it's, come on. If you're what's affordable in the middle of Toronto? Basically, nothing.
Well, that's right. There's very little that's affordable. When we try and do that, we try and do it about 20-25% below market. And we try and have a building constructed. That's what we do up here in York Center, where they commit to a certain number of units that'll be below market for sometimes 25 years, sometimes 49 years, sometimes 99 years. And that's part of a negotiation. But, you know, in a city where land costs are so much and building costs are so much, you're already in the hole by tens of millions of dollars before you've laid a brick. So building affordable does have its challenges.
Yeah, building affordable does have its challenges. What are your thoughts, Taylor? I mean, are you just giving up on this, or do you think that there it would be a way to make it more affordable for you? And hey, you've got a good job. You're not, it's not like you're somehow disadvantaged.
No, absolutely. I'm in a very fortunate situation, which, you know, many people my age, unfortunately, are not. You know, I think we're seeing progress on this issue in some parts of the country. You know, if you look at the housing starts data that came out this week, BC is pushing well ahead of Ontario. And I think a lot of that is thanks to some of the changes that they've made to make it easier to build in the city of Vancouver. And here in Toronto, we're taking steps towards that, but we really haven't gone as far as they have. You know, despite the number of cranes that you see as a proportion of the population, it's not keeping up with the demand.
And let me ask you a political question. Do you think this announcement yesterday, geared at millennials, geared at some Gen X, do you think that's going to make, you know, that younger generation, a lot of them are going towards Pierre Poilievre and the Conservative Party. Do you think that that will change their minds?
I think that landed with a thud. You know, Libby, I don't know a single person my age who is voting for Justin Trudeau in the next election. And that is a great change from 2015, when virtually everyone I knew was voting for Justin Trudeau. So, well, he's got a real problem there.
Well, I am glad to hear that the people you know that are your age are voting. So
Yeah, there you go.
There I go.
That's
yes.
The first step.
That is the first step. But yeah, it was something else. I mean, I almost think that this whole issue of housing, I don't know, it's a lot of blah, 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 Paula Fletcher.
Yep, proof is in the pudding. So, Taylor, I have all these sites that have been approved, and they're just sitting there. That really concerns me. Once you've gotten approval, and there's supposed to be this many built, including once at the beer store. You know, there's the model at the beer store where they sell the property and then somebody builds it and then they put the beer store in the bottom commercial space. So I'm concerned what's going on here, and some of them have been sitting like that longer than when the interest rates got higher. I do think that James and I supported the city building process, or use our city lands, get started, get market, below market, long-term tenure for tenants, long-term tenure for affordable housing, kind of kickstart it. So it is not an easy industry, and it's become more difficult with the land costs, as James pointed out. For the city, we don't have that issue. For TCHC, we don't have that issue. The interest rates, the number of people that are working in the industry, and it is continuing to boom, I think, in Toronto. There are more cranes here than most other places, but it's not that affordable, Libby.
Okay, and moving right along to the provincial budget that was unveiled on Tuesday afternoon, what is your reaction, James Pasternak? I've seen criticism about not much there or nothing there for transit, and it was supposed to address affordability. Do you think it did?
Well, when it comes to these budgets, it's never enough. Housing, they put an envelope of $1 billion together. Community support and recreation, $200 million. They've announced an initiative to declare provincial land surplus for building housing. And, of course, they've committed to supportive housing. I assume that's for those who are having various mental issues or substance abuse issues or seniors who need that. There's investments in critical infrastructure, $396 million in mental health. Look, I mean, there's a bit of a shopping list here of stuff that we do want, and not much in the way of daycare. But I think the province feels, well, we've already given Toronto as much as we can through the New Deal, and we'll try and top it up as we go forward. So I think the view here is Toronto's gotten its share, and we weren't expecting a whole lot in this budget.
Paula?
It's pretty interesting. No, it's not a big cuts budget. That's a good thing. The surplusing of provincial lands, unless it's clear that there needs to be a quotient of affordable housing, really does concern me, Libby. Why we have the West Don lands and on the waterfront, those were all provincial lands, and they've delivered market housing, and they've delivered a ton of affordable housing in a mixed community. So I'm hoping we'll further hear that that's going to be the approach, and it's not just going to be a developer bonanza for building on provincial sites. The provincial government can do what the city does, which is we're turning over our sites. James, you have a big one up in your ward, 30% affordable, 30% market, and 30% condos. So it's a great, it works.
Okay, let's take a call from Susan in Toronto. Hi, Susan.
Hi. You know, as I'm looking around, I see nothing but new places going up everywhere I drive, and there is nothing that is affordable to someone with a, you know, regular income. Apartments, one bedroom apartments are like almost, they can be 2,500, 3,000. How did they can build apartments from now till the cows come home, and there isn't enough. The condos are, you know, expensive. When I was younger, you know, a person in their 30s could get an apartment. Not now. So when they say they're working on it, they're not. They're not working on it. Nothing's happening. And I'm angry. And that's my comment. There is no affordable housing.
Okay, Susan, I'm going to see if either of the counselors have a response for you. Thank you so much for that. So, response?
Susan.
I run the risk of being defensive. We have numerous programs that help people who need shelter, whether it's affordable benefits, landlord-tenant agreements, the Housing Now initiative. Firm goals in various developments, such as 10% affordable, 20% affordable. So is it perfect? Does it meet the demands? No, it's never enough. But to say we're doing nothing is really, really not correct. We're doing the best we can with the resources we have. And at times I do question, whether it's truly affordable in this marketplace.
Well, and it's also the people. There are lineups of people, and they aren't all people that we would consider disadvantaged. They're regular people with good jobs, and they can't afford it.
Can I jump in, Libby? Because there's a provincial requirement. We know we have passed an inclusionary zoning bylaw here and sent it up to the province. That means that all those big towers, all those things that you see around transit stations, are supposed to have a quotient of affordable housing there. They have not confirmed our bylaw. Around the Ontario line and all the new transit, they have something called transit-oriented communities where they're giving super density to developers. There's no requirement that a certain percentage of those will be affordable. I agree with James. The city is stepping up. Each of us is driving to have a certain number of affordable in every development that we have, particularly ones the city owns. But there's no requirement for any developer to add any affordable housing, even when they're getting 60 stories or 70 stories. And that's a provincial policy. And I really, Susan, I agree with you. That should change. We would see a different scope for tenants and others if we had that.
Okay, let's take a call from John in Toronto. Hi, John.
Hi. Hi. What are you politicians doing to give Canadians a chance to breathe, a chance to live? You say that I forgot what you said, but it's almost like as if we're going a step down, or you're stomping on us and bringing us down. You mean this is a sanctuary city, and people who came last are being served first, and those who are paying for everything are being neglected to create this crisis.
Okay, John, thanks for that. I'm looking at the clock. We don't have very much time left. I want to talk a little bit about the congestion and the closures. I mean, even around here, there are some roads that are all closed. Like, literally, you can't go anywhere without driving through half the city. And we've just seen the Gardner closures start. And, you know, again, we keep hearing promises that this is going to be done with some kind of intelligence, and it isn't.
Well, there's no doubt that when you replace aging infrastructure, you're going to have major road closures because that is the only way to get the job done. I know it's inconvenient, it's messy, it's noisy, it's frustrating, but for those who have homes or businesses nearby, this will protect their businesses, this will protect their homes, and this will make for safer sidewalks and safer roads.
I can tell you that, James, I can tell you that where I live in Midtown, the main roads have been ripped up more times than I can count.
Yep.
I'm talking about Bathurst and DuPont, more times than I can count. I've just heard from a colleague who lives in Etobicoke that lane restrictions, there was never a problem going home, and now there are huge lineups and no one in the bike lanes. Taylor.
Yeah, I mean, it's another, I would say, failure to prepare for growth. You know, the city has grown a ton in the past few years even. And when it comes to housing, when it comes to transit, when it comes to all these things, we just don't have the infrastructure to support that growth yet.
Okay, I'm going to have to wrap things up because I am out of time. Thank you so much, Councillor Paula Fletcher, Councillor James Pasternak, and Taylor Scollin. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks very much, Libby. Take care.
Thank you. Okay, we are taking a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to the opposition leader, Merit Styles, about her take on the budget.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back, and now I'd like to welcome NDP opposition leader Merit Styles. Her reaction to Tuesday's largest ever provincial budget is that there's nothing there that will help people in Ontario, and I'd like to understand exactly what she means, especially in the healthcare sector, and especially regarding the $2 billion for home care, which quite a few key stakeholders are happy and hopeful about. Merit Styles, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Okay, so that's what I want to ask about. You said really there's nothing in this budget, and the one thing that people seem to really be happy about was that $2 billion over 3 years for home care.
You know, I think this is an increase, certainly from the 2023 budget. But I just want to point out, I mean, one of the things that happened in the last budget was the government allocated about $1 billion then, and then actually very little of that actually went out and delivered change. So I think, you know, we're happy to see investments there in home care. We are big fans of home care in the NDP, of course. We need to make sure that people can stay in their homes and stay well longer. But I think unless that money is actually getting out the door and getting to the caregivers who really need who are the ones who are going to be providing the care, it's really just words in a document. And I think that's my biggest concern. This budget overall was the largest. I mean, this is the biggest spending budget we've seen. We've got a deficit now of $10 billion, which is extraordinary, the largest deficit in Ontario history. But what we're concerned about is that so little of this budget and this spending is actually going into directly helping people in the ways that we know people need support. So, for example, if you're looking for a family doctor, if you're a young person trying to find affordable housing, or if you're struggling with the cost of living, this budget isn't really for you.
Okay. I'd like to go back to home care, and they have $550 million for Ontario health teams, which they say will help people. Now, I find it really interesting, and I talk to very senior doctors all the time, and I unfortunately have huge personal experience with the healthcare system. And the one thing that a lot of people keep telling me, and that includes Franche Gélinas, who I have a great deal of respect for, is that it's the money will fix it. Well, now we're seeing money, and I personally don't think that money, for instance, for those health teams is necessarily going to fix it in the midst of a shortage of doctors who don't want to go into that practice. But all the stakeholders, you talk to union people, and they all say what we need is money, and now there's money. So where do you see the problem?
Well, I think the difference is a difference between spending and then investing with care, right? And what we're seeing here, and I certainly am a big fan of these, you know, interdisciplinary health teams. That's definitely something we've advocated for. But like you said, I mean, one of the biggest dilemmas we have right now is the shortage of family physicians, primary care doctors. We have 2.3 million Ontarians right now without access to that. And unfortunately, as you said, a lot of our new doctors are not wanting to go into family medicine. And one of the major reasons that they cite and why people are actually leaving family medicine is because of the very large administrative burden on family physicians. The OMA, the Medical Association, estimates that family doctors are spending 19 hours a week, 40% of their time on paperwork. And so one of the things, and we were hoping we'd see in this budget, was a real effort from the government to relieve that administrative burden. Some of that means connecting them to those health teams, absolutely. But other healthcare workers, administrative support, there are some really solid proposals coming forward for how to relieve that burden. And it would instantly, you know, honestly mean that those family physicians that are out there would be able to see more patients, not do so much paperwork. We could see a lot more people who don't have family care right now. And we would also be, I think, encouraging more of those medical students to go into family medicine.
Well, I think everybody agrees that the admin burden is really, really high, and it's an admin burden on doctors. One of the other things that's cited, because a lot of those regulations don't necessarily come from the government, they might be from the profession itself. And I think one of the things that rankles doctors anyway is the way the fee schedule works. And there are certain procedures that have become much easier and quicker over time, certainly in radiology, say, that get paid very highly, where procedures like talking to a patient for a long period of time do not get paid very well. And a lot of that has to do not with the government, but with the OMA and with other regulatory bodies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot that, as I talk to a lot of frontline physicians about where they want to see change, and I think they have conversations to have with their college, for example, and with the government about billing. I think that's a really important conversation that they're having. And absolutely, you know, again, I want to say we are big fans of that interdisciplinary team approach, which I want to say doctors generally are as well.
Yeah.
They are certainly seeming to appreciate that a lot more. I mean, I remember when I got started and was doing a lot of healthcare policy work like 20 years ago, this was something that a lot of family physicians weren't as open to at the time. That's really changed. They're looking for those opportunities to work with other healthcare professionals in a team environment. And what we're seeing, and the government's announcement is a start, but when you look at, you know, what they're aiming to, I think, connect with about 600,000 more people, that's great, but it's still only a drop in the bucket, and the bucket is very leaky right now. 2.3 million people currently without primary care. In by 2026, that's going to get up to about 4 million, about a quarter of the population of Ontario. So we're not even going to, we're getting some way towards addressing that, but not fast enough.
Well, and you know, you talk about administrative burden. Yesterday, I had my medical panel, and our family physician that we talked to here, well, she was saying that in terms of health teams, which I think are terrific, generally speaking, they are affiliated with big hospitals, that the admin burden for applying for them is very difficult. And she is licensed under a different model. I mean, this is, again, like huge bureaucracy and admin. And she could not move to it because her deal says something else.
Yeah, it's not. They're not making it easy, right?
No.
I mean, simply put, and you know, I was in, I was at a Queen's University just a few weeks ago. I met with Dr. Jane Philpott, right?
Oh, yes.
The Dean of Medicine there. She's got a new book coming out, which I'm really excited about. But you know, one of the things that she said was, "Look, we've seen how all of these different models work. We've seen what's good about them, what's not working so well. We've had lots of time to look at that. We need to learn. We need to learn from it, and we need to make it easier. We need to be able to create more of these more quickly. And certainly, you know, we don't need to be repeating the same mistakes and making things more complicated than they need to be. But it's not easy. And I agree with you. I think there's a lot of obstacles and barriers that, again, I think are very frustrating for folks who work and are trying to actually fix the system from within. Because at the end of the day, you know, when we talk about family practitioners, you know, family doctors, when we talk about nurse practitioners and all of those great people out there, they want to see patients. They want to spend the time they need with them. They want to do it in the most, I mean, frankly, efficient way possible, too. But a lot of these solutions exist out there on the front lines. And I'm seeing it in hospitals, public hospitals, where they're really coming up with innovative ways to address some of the wait lists, the surgical backlogs within the public system. And, you know, this is, of course, I'm a New Democrat. I really believe in our public healthcare system. And I want to make sure that we are also being very careful with the public purse, right? We are seeing that a lot of the solutions that the government's coming up with that are focused on private, for-profit delivery of a lot of these procedures now, this is actually costing our system more.
You know, Merritt, I'm going to jump in there. We've discussed that quite a lot here, and it's a whole separate conversation. And unfortunately, I'm looking at the time, and we're out of time. And I hope that we can talk again about all of this sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye bye. All righty. We are going to take another break. And when we come back, oh, the grocery chain that Canadians love to hate, Loblaw. And now there is a petition to stop those receipt scanners that are apparently on the horizon. Scan your receipt at the self-checkout or get locked in when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Now we turn to the hugely profitable grocery chain that Canadians love to hate. Of course, I'm talking about Loblaw and specifically their pilot project introducing receipt scanners in self-checkout areas where shoppers will be locked in if they don't have that receipt, if it doesn't scan properly. Well, now a growing petition organized by Lead Now is calling for that policy to be abolished. And they've raised concerns that it creates bottlenecks and embarrassment for customers. The letter also calls for the CEO, Per Bank, to focus on reducing prices and making groceries more affordable. So what do you think about that? I have to say, since we first heard about this move, potentially, I've had huge response on it. I mean, the move to introduce these scanners, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740.
And now I'm joined by Aidan McNally, a campaigner with Lead Now, which is the group that organized the petition, and Bruce Winder, a retail analyst and author. Thank you both for joining me. Hello.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Ricky.
Let us begin with Aidan. So how many people have signed on to this petition?
Yeah, thanks, Libby. So far, over 5,800 people have emailed Loblaw's CEO calling on them to rescind this policy and instead focus on making food more affordable for Canadians, as we know that companies like Loblaw's are the ones driving up the shocking prices that we're seeing.
Bruce Winder, it's not clear that this is a policy yet. This is a pilot project, but as I've said before, I've noticed in my local Loblaw there are gates in the self checkout area. They open right now. You finish your thing and they open automatically. But you know, the question is, if they weren't intent on introducing this thing, why would they have put gates in?
Yeah, I think that Loblaw is trying to wrestle with something that quite a few retailers are looking to wrestle with right now, which is trying to minimize shoplifting or, you know, shrink or theft, while still trying to protect and enhance the customer relationship. And that's why I think they're trying to test this out. And again, I think it is just a 4-store test. So my understanding is it's not a rollout yet. You know, I think they're probably going to listen to what consumers are saying, right? There's been quite a few instances of consumers, whether it's, you know, writing in directly to the management team or signing this petition. And I think it's a tough one. I mean, I think they're trying to sort of, you know, balance that. This may not be in balance, though, with that approach.
Yeah, well, I know that they just have the scanners in a few stores, but those gates are there. So are you saying that they would just get rid of the gates? I mean, again, if you look at the layout, it doesn't, you know, a gate is not necessary unless the gate closes for some reason.
Yeah, I think the gate thing is irking people quite a bit because you feel like you're sort of caught in there, like, you know, and it's probably something I would imagine that they're going to look at because, you know, people aren't used to being sort of gated in and gated out that way. So I think they're going to have to look at that and rethink that maybe.
Okay. Aidan, what kinds of things are you hearing from the people who are supporting your move?
Yeah, Libby, I think we're hearing the same thing, that, you know, shoppers are feeling senses of embarrassment or, you know, feeling like they're being accused of theft in as they're trying to go through purchasing their groceries. And this announcement shows that Loblaws is out of touch with the general public and what's going on right now. You know, I think the question we're not asking is why people can't afford their groceries. And, you know, what we've seen is that Loblaws continues to post and has actually doubled their profits since the pandemic as Canadians are struggling to afford their groceries. And I think that is also fueling this scrutiny and this pushback.
Yeah, I mean, lately I do see some, I have seen some good sales there, but their PR seems just to be terrible. You know, we had the whole boondoggle with that discount, the 50% discount that was dropped to a 30% discount and then came back after the public complained. Bruce, you know, what aren't they getting about all of this?
Yeah, I'm not really sure sort of what's going on there in terms of inside Loblaw, but I imagine at some point they're going to sort of see, you know, a bit of an impact to sales based on some negative sentiment. And I would imagine, I mean, they're a smart company. They're probably going to probably change the way they look at some of these things and you know, try to make sure they make that balance, like I talked about earlier, of making money, minimizing shoplifting, but really building on that customer relationship. So, you know, I'm not sure why, you know, why they did this test. I guess they're desperate. They're trying to find ways to minimize shrink, which is a real issue in the industry. But
yeah.
I think that, you know, I think they're a company that I think is starting to become open to feedback. You know, and I use the point that The other week, you mentioned about how they had the discount for foods at 50 and then went to 30. The good news is, I think within a few days of that, they reversed it and went back to 50.
Yeah, right. But reversing it after a lot of really bad publicity is not the same as getting it right and keeping it right.
I think they're starting to listen, maybe. I think they're starting to listen only because they did reverse it. So that tells me that maybe they're rethinking some of their approach.
Okay. And then there's the issue of these self-checkouts altogether. Aidan, do you have any feedback on that? Because obviously they have self-checkouts to get rid of cashier's jobs. Those are people who can use those jobs, and they're getting the customers to do, frankly, some of the work that they paid other people for. Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, Libby, I think that's a good question. I mean, what we're seeing is that Loblaws is making cuts wherever possible and are posting, again, record profits since the pandemic began. I think that's being shown in food prices that are being increased beyond the rate of inflation. It also, as you said, looks like these cost-cutting measures, like implementing things like self-checkout. So I think that this consumer anger is very warranted and is largely about Loblaws' role in driving the cost of living crisis.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Bruce in Vaughan. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, go ahead.
I read it in the paper the other day. Costco's checked your receipts since they open at the door. Nobody complains about that. And I'd rather, though, that, like you said about saving salaries, reducing cashiers, well, then put another and more qualified person in the self-checkout. Our store has, 9 terminals. And there's like one person there. Most of the time, they're not allowed to do alcohol. So you've got to wait for somebody else to come over. And they've got to come over every time you do the 50% discount. Sometimes you're done and you're waiting another 5 minutes for them to come and clear the scanner for you.
Well, yeah, and but you're probably not waiting as long as if you got into the lineup for the one or two cashiers that they're leaving on duty. Thanks, Bruce, for your call. And I gather that the issue with Costco is it's a membership, and it's written clearly that they're going to check your receipts, unlike Loblaw, where I don't even see signs posted saying, whatever the conditions are, Bruce.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit of a different business model. I mean, Costco's been doing it forever since they started, when this is fairly new, and it's a sensitive environment. The odd thing about just listening to some of the banter on the self-checkout, believe it or not, there's actually a lot of people who like self-checkout. Some people really enjoy the speed of it, where other people don't. They want to talk to a person. So it's one of those things the industry hasn't worked out. And this isn't just Loblaw, believe it or not. This discussion is happening all around the world as companies are trying to utilize new technology, reduce time for waiting, but also try to minimize theft, but also preserve the customer experience. So this is sort of a dilemma that the industry finds itself in. And
Yeah, we've heard about companies in Britain that have a couple of so-called slow lanes for people who want to talk. My sentiment is, okay, if you've got a few things with a barcode, it's fine, but I'm not going to start weighing produce and all of that because Galen Weston isn't paying me to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Target in the U.S., I believe, has started a program where you can use self-checkout if you have 10 items or less. But if you don't, then they want you to use cashiers, right? So it's a little bit all over the map right now in terms of how different retailers are responding to it.
Yeah, and so how do you see things shaking out, Bruce?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm really not sure. I mean, I know that's, If I think a lot of retailers, if they could wave their magic wand, they would use something like Amazon has, which is this just walk out technology, which is being used in the Saddledome and the Rogers Center. And basically, you scan your credit card or debit card when you walk in. You take what you need off the shelf, and you walk out, and you automatically get charged for it.
And does it work well?
It does work pretty well. It costs a little bit of money, though, to set up. That's the problem, right? It costs a few hundred grand per store to get the AI set up, the camera set up, the sensor scan set up. Probably be a lot more for a place like Loblaw because of the size of the place. But that's probably, I have a feeling, where the industry is going to end up in 5 or 10 years. But it could be a little bumpy between where we are now and that future state.
Well, I don't know. I've read about that, and I know a lot of people are fairly creeped out by it. That's a lot of scanning and photographing and all of that. I'm looking at the clock. Boy, this is a conversation I think that won't go away, but right now we are out of time. Thank you so much, Bruce Winder and Aidan McNally.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
And that's all the time we have for today. Free for All Friday coming up tomorrow. Jane Brown will be here. And please call in and we'll talk about what you want to talk about.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.